Thank you for joining me today. You have found the Third Space Podcast, and I'm your host, Bob Fabey. And today, we're talking with Pastor Monty Wright. You will hear a discussion about Revelation, Y2K, the Game of Thrones, three-headed beasts, the pressure that's on the church, and the role of Christians in society. I hope you enjoy. With me today is the Reverend Pastor, Archetype, Builder of all sorts of spiritual things, author and friend, Monty Wright. Monty, welcome.
Hey, Bob. It's great to be here with you today.
I'm happy to have you on the show. For those of you who don't know, Monty is the pastor of SVA. Monty, what's SVA?
SVA is Snoqualmie Valley Alliance Church. We are like 30 miles outside of Seattle. So we're in the burbs of Seattle. Beautiful area. Snoqualmie Falls is probably its claim to fame, but it's a great place for hiking and feeling the beauty of nature.
Yeah, it's beautiful there. When the sun is shining, it's remarkable. It's unlike anything because of the green up there.
The green is just unique.
When the sun is shining is the issue.
It shines, you know, don't let them fool you.
At 4 o'clock on Thursday.
It never rains in Seattle ever.
I tell you,
you come out of winter here and you are praying for the sun to come back. You start to get a little depressed by the end of February,
right.
March.
Yeah.
But then the sun hits and it truly is one of the most beautiful places
That's breathtaking.
In the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Being from Western Montana originally, we understand the gray, socked in winters that never seem to end. It really is glorious out there when things kind of break. I'm just happy to have you on the show. I wanted to highlight a couple things. You've written a couple books. I want to make sure I get the title correct. Sacred Space, correct?
Yeah, Sacred Space. Yep. And in fact, I've got a four-day retreat coming up in August that I base off that book, the movements in that book, at Mount Angel Abbey. Really great place down in Oregon.
Okay.
And so, yeah, we move in and out of all of the different rhythms of Sacred Space. And, you know, life gets so crazy that it's hard to connect with God. So these are rhythms just that work for you to build into your life, to stay connected to God when your world is a bit chaotic.
Yeah. And I think that's true for pretty much everyone as far as that goes. So yeah, Monty's written a book, Sacred Space. I encourage you to check it out on Amazon. And it's really about a way for making space in your relationship with God in the middle of, like you said, kind of maybe busyness or chaos.
Yeah,
I'm really grateful for that. And also, and I want to kind of jump in a little bit on this. Monty's written a book on rescuing Revelation.
Yes.
It says, what Christ's return means for his church beyond the rapture. For those of you who don't know, you know, the book of Revelation is the last book of the Bible, and it's largely confusing, right?
Yeah, it's the last book of the Bible and the last book most Christians read, right? Even Christians who've read it is like, hey, yeah, I started that and I just put it down. It scared me or terrified me.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a hard book on one level, but I believe it's far easier than the church has made it.
Yeah, it's accessible.
Sense to you. I think we've made a mess of something that was pretty understandable to the original readers.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And is that kind of what you wrote it for? Were you thinking like, hey, I want to help people kind of get there with this book or what?
I would say the main reason I finally tackled Revelation, I mean, for years I've had people say, man, would you teach Revelation? I was like, that's going to be a ton of work to unpack that. And then part of me is going, If I teach you the real heartbeat of this book, it's going to be radically different than what you've been taught and what you think it is. And it might actually cause you some pain and a lot of discomfort to go, well, I've been believing this my whole life.
Yeah.
But I finally got to that point where I felt, yeah, let's dig into this, because at the heart of it, it's a beautiful, inspiring, encouraging letter for people who find themselves stuck in a world system of oppression, of empire. And so we are experiencing that today. So I really think Revelation speaks profoundly to the church today, but also to the world today.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I was really grateful when I got the copy and I was really grateful for your approach. If you get a chance, check out the book Rescuing Revelation by Monty Wright on Amazon. What Monty does is he brings the difficulty of a Hebrew apocalyptic literature text. That's a mouthful. To make it tangible, reachable. So if you have questions about Revelation, this is a helpful book to help you walk through. And as a matter of fact, you made it kind of a workbook as you go. After every chapter, you have an opportunity to answer some questions and take down some notes.
Yep. Yeah. You're getting to help you engage it. I kind of look at it as it's not your de facto commentary on Revelation. Yeah. I really feel it's a great companion. If you're reading through it and you read through my chapters that are, aligning, that it's going to give you some commentary-esque insight, but I think it's going to help guide your reading to give you some wisdom about, I wouldn't have thought of it that way. It's also, there's a couple churches that I've been talking with that are doing it as a small group too.
And, that's great.
So it's been kind of fun to call into a small group that's that's going through your book. And what did you mean here?
Right.
Right. That's been kind of fun too.
Yeah. And so you said, it's like, hey, beyond the rapture. What were you trying to get at when you put that in your tagline and in your subtitle?
In my take. All right. Yeah. So most people, okay, I shouldn't say most. this is one of the reasons I wrote the book. So the whole Left Behind series, right? Left Behind theology. When I first gave my life to Christ, I was all in for that. I read every book a guy named Hal Lindsey ever wrote. I don't know. Do you?
Oh,
do
yeah.
You
I remember Hal Lindsey. Yep. Yep.
So it's like 1983. He wrote the book Late Great Planet Earth. It's like 73. Sorry. Yeah. Sometime in the 70s. Late Great Planet Earth. Satan's alive and well on planet Earth. There's a new world coming. And then in the 80s, it was sometime in the early 80s, he wrote this book called The Rapture. So I gave my life to Christ in 83. That was like the Christian book.
Right.
And it was all about the rapture, the second coming of Christ, 7 years of just divine wrath poured out on the earth. And then people are going to be raptured. Airplane pilots are going to be raptured out and the plane's going down because the pilot was a Christian and no one else was. And, so cars driving down the street. If you were a Christian, you're raptured out of your car. Nothing's left but your tennis shoes. Right. And so I read that, Bob, and I was just like all in. The first 2 years of my Christianity were nothing but Daniel and Isaiah and Hal Lindsey. And then I don't know what happened. I hit a point and I just went, I don't know. I'm not so sure if that's the right view. Now this many years into my walk, that whole view of, a tribulation, a 7 year tribulation period, and a rapture, a secret rapture of the church that happens either at the beginning of this 7 year period, in the middle, or at the end. That was never even a doctrine or a theology until the mid 1800s. A guy named Darby, and Darby came up with this whole concept of dispensationalism, from which we get, this concept. And it's like, that was even news to me. It's like, so what did Peter believe?
Yeah. What did people think before that?
What did Paul believe? Yeah. Because this belief that really has captured evangelicalism and given us an urgency for missions. But on the other side, it's given us a complete lack of stewardship of the earth, because we're like, it's all going to burn anyway. Don't care for the earth. This doctrine has some flaws.
Yeah.
And as I have found it, it actually isn't true.
It promotes Gnosticism, actually, in my mind, where it's like, the spirit's good and the flesh is bad, or the spiritual realm is positive and the physical realm is negative. And
yeah, it does. Yeah.
I'm like, hey, wait a minute. Gnosticism's been around for a really long time. This is a form of neo-Gnosticism where I just kind of shake my head. And I remember early on in my development as well, where it's, are you pre-trib, pre-mill, pre-rapture, I sat there and I was like, I'm not sure this is really central to what it is that I'm supposed to be about. And that was one thing that I noticed in your book. You kept coming back to, you kept helping people re-land in the place of, yeah, you're here and you're grappling with this material, but how does this play out in the everyday life kind of thing?
Well, yeah. And I think, you know, Bob, one of my goals for the book was not to try to prove or align it with any theory. Mm-hmm. You know, is it pre-mill, post-mill? Is it a-mill? Is there a tribulation? You know, I just wanted the letter to be opened up, because the reality is, so John writes this letter to seven very real churches, mm-hmm. who are stuck with the boot of the empire firmly on the neck of the churches, yep. and they're struggling. And, you know, what historically would have happened, each of the churches would have, you know, got this letter, this vision, this unveiling, the apocalypses, and they would have sat and it would have been read in like one sitting. They would have listened to the words, and it was written to encourage them, not terrify them. It was written to help them stand together in solidarity so that they knew God is still at work even when the world looks crazy.
Yeah.
And they would have understood all of the imagery in the book. Mm-hmm. And that's an important piece. If they would have understood everything that John was saying in his letter, in his unveiling to them, then we can't start inserting Apache helicopters and, you know, all these other things right. that we have. Well,
this is clearly Russia.
This is Mikhail Gorbachev. Yeah. He's the Antichrist. He's got this mark on his head. Right. You know, I've heard so many things over the years.
Yeah.
But they would have understood it, and it was written to inspire and help them stay strong. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. when Rome was coming down so heavily on the church.
Yeah. Yeah. And not to mention, even within their own context, just whether it be poverty or difficulty with food or trade or any of those things. I mean, life is super hard at this point. And yeah. you have Rome, and you have Jewish leaders, and you have, I mean, so it was not easy to be a Christian at the time that this book was written.
Yeah. Yeah. Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. Yeah. Well, and then you mentioned it too. We have this apocalyptic literature. I think early on, when we talk about genres, you know, the way we read and interpret and crack into genres is actually really important. We get a hermeneutical lens, you know, for the theology geeks listening out there, the hermeneutical lens from which we read the book of Revelation. you know, we have history. We'll look at a historical book through one lens versus a prescriptive letter like Paul's, or more prescription, Acts is history. Mm-hmm. And so this is the crazy thing about this book, is that there's multiple genres mm-hmm. in this book. Mm-hmm. You know, I think early on I note that I call it a poetic, prophetic, apocalyptic epistle.
Right.
And so right there it is poetry. It is prophetic, it's apocalyptic, and it's got the prescriptions of an epistle too, but the church has tended to use one lens,
yeah.
which is just a very literal prescriptive hermeneutic.
Yeah.
And I think that's robbed it, and I think that's where it's created a lot of the confusion in the book.
Yeah, especially what last 150 years, 150,
yeah,
200
absolutely.
Years, you know, and in the West, you know, I think there's churches out there who look at the West's read of Revelation and they just go, what did you just say? Like, do you really, you know, like, wait just a second. So I actually want to turn to the book if you don't mind. And I'm looking at how you talk about the seven churches. And you use what you call the 5P template, which talks about how Jesus addresses the seven churches, and it talks about place, picture, praise, problem, and prescription. And for those of you who are listening, I would encourage you, if you're reading through Revelation, take a look at those five words and consider what it is that each church is being told. You know, the place,
yeah,
the picture, the praise, the problem, and the prescription. Because Monty, when you go through and you talk about the different churches, I think you do a great job of kind of pointing those things out along the way. As a matter of fact, you clearly do that. And one of the things I wanted to talk about is to the Church of Pergamum. You said this when it's in Revelation chapter 2. you say on page 64, the principle of the Christian life is not escape, but conquest. Though Jesus is well aware of what his children are going through, the response should not be to run away from difficulties, but to run to him. Man, I so appreciated that, because what I see or hear is too much of the, and I really love this song, but I'll Fly Away. You know, it's just like, okay, either I'm going to die and run away, or I'm just going to get sucked off the planet. You know, it just flies in the face of what people would have actually understood the text to mean. It's one of the troubles with the Bible is that we don't know exactly what they were saying in the first century. And it's our job to try to unpack what a first century hearer would understand so that we can apply that to our lives today.
Well, I'm glad you bring that up, because I mean, I think over and over, whenever the church gets comfortable, the church wants to settle. Mm-hmm. The church wants to bunker. Mm-hmm. The church, you know, church wants to have the holy huddle. Mm-hmm. And over time, do you remember Y2K?
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So Y2K 2000, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the world was going to end.
Yep.
The computers were going to take over and crash, because everything was built on, you know, this world system of electronics. I had just planted Snoqualmie Valley SVA. I just planted SVA in November of 99. So I plant right in the height of Y2K, and I'm a bit sarcastic, but in my normal life, I remember we did a unplugged Y2K service. We said, hey, we'll be here no matter what. But there was a number of people that I talked to that literally were packing up and heading for the hills.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, we're getting out of here. I've got my water, my food, I've got a cabin. We're going to live off the grid, because, you know, this is the tribulation. Right. You know, this is Revelation is happening. These 7 years of hell poured out on the earth. And my conversation with them was, well, one, I didn't believe that. I said, I think you're overreacting. But I said, number two, where in Scripture does Jesus ever tell us as the church, that when hard times come, we should just flee, you know? And I said, our job is to stand. Our job is to stand firm. Boy, if there's any word that pops out of Revelation, it's stand firm, stand together. I'm with you to the very end, right? And I talked to a number of people of just how freaked out they were about the world and potential tribulation. But so with Pergamum, you know, he says to them, you know, I know where you dwell. I know how tough it is for you. I know how hard it is for you right now. I know you live in the place where Satan is worshipped. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Jesus knew, since his followers had Trinity within them, that they could stand firm.
Yeah.
Even Paul in his letter to the Ephesians, right, you know, that's when at the end, when he's talking about putting on the armor, he says, don't put on the armor so that you can, you know, keep taking ground. He says, at the end of the day, your job is to stand firm. And I think that's a powerful voice that needs to come out of Scripture to Christians. It's, man, God is always at the center, even when you think he's been marginalized by culture.
Yeah.
Culture doesn't know God is always what is center. The voice always comes from the center. So stand firm. He's got it.
Yeah. And not be this, you know, I mean, I the onward Christian soldier kind of stuff where it's like, no, we've got to take back, you know, ground, we have to do. And I'm just so uncomfortable with that kind of language, because it's like, look, what I see is not a Messiah who's out there, you know, fighting for ground. I see somebody who's standing in the face of things and who's willing to actually die in the midst of standing in those, you know, in the face of those things, you know? Yeah. And you say, you know, you kind of follow this through, and I'm kind of passing through the book a little bit quickly, but you say everything is about grace. Everything's about relationship. It's not about rules and check boxes, but how Christians relate to each other when mistakes are made. Remember, truth cannot be sacrificed at the altar of pretend tolerance. With God's grace, differences can be accepted without compromising faith and relationships. Doing so will help guard the church today from falling into the same church as Thyatira. So, Monty, how does that play out when other people read Revelation differently than you do?
Well, they're just wrong.
You didn't check these boxes. You're wrong. You didn't
check these boxes.
Yeah.
Well, there's the conversation, you know, of the day right there. You know, religion is all about the checking the boxes. You know, religion is, hey, if you think like we do, you check the same boxes we do, you can join our club, right?
Right.
And then you're in. We'll take care of you. We love you. But you have to believe the same things, behave the same ways. Jesus, that's the beauty of Jesus. He is the exact opposite. He's like, well, you don't have to believe right or even think right or have your life cleaned up. Just follow me. That stuff happens along the way.
Yeah.
And because the transformation is based off the relationship, not based off the checkboxes. Mm-hmm. When we live by the checkboxes, then someone else has determined your faith steps.
Yeah.
And so I feel today one of the things that we are unable to do, and you can go anywhere you want with this, I feel like we can't even have conversations where we differ.
We can't.
Anymore.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I feel like we've got to this point that to love someone, I just have to completely agree with them on everything. That's right. And accept everything that somehow disagreements
equals hate.
Yeah. And I was like, man, look at a marriage, right? You know, there's a lot of times when we have disagreements in marriage or we're coming at things from different angle, but love is always constant. Love is always there. If I only loved my wife, Amy, when she agreed with me, that would be a lonely marriage. Right. Yeah. But I feel we acquiesce to the altar of tolerance in order to keep a sense of unity, but it's a pseudo unity.
Totally.
Rather than actually choosing to love someone, even though we greatly might disagree.
Yeah.
And even when it comes down to the way we interpret or look at the book of Revelation, is can we, or heck, pick an issue in the church, right?
Right.
You know, you can pick a women in ministry issue in church. One side says this, one side says this.
Abortion,
conversation. One side says this. It's like, wow, Jesus somehow was able to offer a third way in every single conversation where what he said was true, yet no one felt uncomfortable to be with him. That's my dream for the church is like, hey, we might be maybe we're not on the same page, but we're not like throwing stones at each other or people aren't uncomfortable around us. But they're like, wow, that person genuinely loves. And if we genuinely love, that's supposed to be our calling card in John 13. Right.
Right. Yeah.
That's the way we love folks.
It's supposed to be the hallmark of a Christian. Right. Yeah. What drives me crazy is, this idea that, we've already kind of brought it out, but this idea that I can't disagree with you. And I'm like, I don't agree with myself. Yeah. I mean, I know the right thing to do and I don't do it. I'm a hypocrite or those kinds of things. And I think, oh, well, what does that mean? You know? And I just go like, wait, if the prerequisite for us being in community is that we believe and do all the same thing, I'm like, this isn't going to work. And so part of the thing that I've heard churches say before is, the equation is you have to behave, believe to belong, right?
Right.
Instead of, hey, you belong, you're going to learn to behave and believe as you go.
Yeah.
That's been used for all sorts of abuses, but it's also, I think, a healthy way forward where it's like, look, I'm trying to figure this out too. You can be with me in it.
Yeah. Well, we're going through a series on following Christ right now at SVA. And, you know, one of the big hallmarks is you just look at the lives of the apostles. None of them were believers that he was the Son of God. None of them believed he came to die for their sins. So first, then you have to ask yourself, so what did he mean by follow me then?
Right.
Right. You know, so when Jesus says follow me, he extended that to sinners. He extended that to Matthew sitting at the tax collector booth that even his early posse didn't want to join them. Right. Like, dude's a tax collector, man. Right. No, that's the low. There's sinners and then there's tax collectors, right? You know, and so, and then, but he says, hey, we're going to your house for dinner. Every single person that Jesus invites to follow him is a sinner, is broken, mm-hmm. struggles, and doesn't behave the right way and doesn't believe the right things.
Yep.
The transformation happens along the way. Somewhere it got flipped in the church that you don't get in. Unless, you know, you get cleaned up, you don't get in unless you believe the way we do or believe right. Yeah. We have turned information into the gospel rather than following, yeah. following Jesus.
Yeah. Instead of transformation. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the thing that grieves me greatly is this idea that somehow we've lost the idea that we too have been in transition. We too have been trying to figure things out. We too don't have all of the we go back to the check boxes, you know, we don't have that all figured out.
Yeah.
And we're still trying to learn, you know, and it's like, I don't know. I don't have all the answers. So I want to lead with love in every way that I can and try to be gracious around people who are on the same journey as I am ultimately. So that I can say, hey, you know what? I don't know what this looks like necessarily. I have an idea and this is where I'm trying to go. And you're welcome to join me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. We'll figure this out along the way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think about like what he says, follow me, you know, my first inclination, you know, because you know, I think historically, right, as I picture being in a boat with my nets and some guy comes along and says, follow me. And I'm like, hey man, I got to clean these nets. I got a wife and kids to feed and I'm pretty tired because we fish all night. What are you talking about? You know, and then walking about 300 yards, you know, and looking back over my shoulder and going, is anybody going to take my nets? Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe trying to shush my kid back to the house while I follow that, you know, don't follow me. Just give me a day or two, or let me, you know, figure out what's going on. And then a few days in, you hear him say do something completely mind blowing. And it's like, what is going on? What does it mean to follow this guy? And I think of that in terms of just kind of a very practical, like I'm leaving what I know to follow you into what I don't know.
Right.
And that when we, I think when we journey with Jesus, it has to be along that line. There has to be kind of this sense of leaving. I really look at Augustine is credited with this. I keep trying to find where he said it, but he says, I believe in order to know. Mm-hmm. And that it's like you can't really know until you walk with him. You can't really walk with him unless you believe to a degree. I mean, it's a goofy dynamic and it's just not all cut and dry and clean and easy.
Well, and I've found just in my following Jesus over the years, he's still throwing out a new invitation. Mm-hmm. And it's he invites you into a new journey. He gives you enough information to take the step. Mm-hmm. Things unfold along the way. You know, when we first I think sometimes we miss out when we think, okay, to follow Jesus means I just have to believe it all. I am walking away from my nets, but Jesus gives us information to help us take each next step along the way. So what's the next step for you? You know, you look back and Jesus was challenging them in key areas. They were, you know, financial areas, relationship areas, work areas, life areas, belief areas. And he would give them a challenge and help walk them through that. And he's still doing that today. I think the church kind of throws it at, okay, this is your moment. Say yes to Jesus. Raise your hand. Everything's answered. You're done. Now you just start going to church and now you start following the checklist, right? Rather than, man, the rest of your life, you're going to have a day going, hey, like John the Baptist, right? Mm-hmm. John the Baptist is in jail, mm-hmm. about to, you know, get beheaded. It's like, hey, could you ask Jesus are you really the one? Or should we expect someone else, right? You know, that whole – and John the Baptist was the one who announced him. John the Baptist was the one that knew he was the Messiah, and he sent his disciples. Yet when life got hard, like Revelation, right? Life got hard. He's in jail. Jesus isn't getting him out.
Right.
Oh, well, does not your messiahship mean you should be rescuing me mm-hmm. from trouble? Why am I still here? And that's, I think it's interesting. Jesus says to John, you know, don't lose your faith on account of me. Mm-hmm. In other words, I'm not coming to get you, John. Don't lose your faith because I'm not doing that thing which you want and think I should do for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. The trouble comes, pressure comes, and God's still there. So who are we becoming in it, though, is the real question.
Yeah, and that's the word thlipsis, correct?
Thlipsis.
Yeah, and you talk about that in the book around the pressure that the churches are feeling in different directions and in different ways. And the goal, if I may, maybe you can correct me on this, but the goal is that somehow even in that pressure, we might look more like Christ and that we might provide people who are under pressure like that, we might provide a place for them to say, wait a minute, there is hope. There's something here.
Absolutely. You
know, and I was really grateful for that point that you made.
Yeah, rather than just freaking out like the rest of the world, we're supposed to have this deeper anchor. Mm-hmm. What does Jesus invite us into by following him over and over again in the Gospels? And John will carry this forward. It was, don't be afraid. Mm. The boat's going to sink. Yeah, don't be afraid. But this is about, don't be afraid. And over what Jesus wants to infuse into his followers is this overwhelming faith that diminishes fear. John picks up on that in the whole book of Revelation because they are in a world of fear. But Jesus, with his presence in the center of their church, wants them to know, no matter how bad it is, I want to infuse you with this faith that overwhelms thlipsis, you know, that pressure, that fear, that conflict, that tribulation, that trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but I still need that.
Oh man. Well, I wish that I operated under pressure that way. I mean, I think about it all the time and I'm like, man, I whine, when things don't go my way, I complain, I want to get out, I want to run, you know, I want to do, the fight or flight, you know, all of those things.
Yeah.
And when I get my wits about me, maybe is the best way to put it. I realize, you know, he's trying to make me into something. He's trying to carve his image in me. He's trying to mold and shape me in a way that will reflect his beauty to the rest of the world. I have to be patient with him in the midst of that. And
yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's incredibly difficult. And here I am, it's 2019, and I'm saying, oh, geez, it's so hard, Jesus. And I don't have Rome's boot on my throat, and I don't have the threat of death, you know, pretty much at my doorstep at any day it could happen kind of thing. We quickly lose our perspective. I was talking the other day about holding grudges. It was in reference to what's happened in Rwanda and what the people of Rwanda have been able to do in light of the genocide that's occurred. And I'm like, how is it that they know Jesus in a way that allows them to forgive and move forward together, not hating, you know, but together somehow?
Yeah.
When here in the West, I'll hold a grudge over something that's just not worthy of holding a grudge over. And I just think, wait a minute, if these guys are forgiving each other for the atrocities that have occurred, what am I doing? You know,
yeah.
It just kind of puts it in perspective.
Absolutely. I don't know if I ever told you, but we have a hostel, actually two hostels that we've built on the Thai-Burma border. Mm. And there's about 60 kids who've lost their parents in the genocide that's going on inside of Burma, mm-hmm. Myanmar, Burma. And I'm heading there next month to go check on them and look at what we need to do next in caring for the kids. But it was a number of years ago when we first got going in there. And some of the teams from Free Burma Rangers, and Dave Eubank, he's one of my partners, and that's who I partner with on the hostels. Well, he's got all these teams inside of Burma that he has raised up and trained from the locals, and some of them were like part of the Karen tribe army, but they come together and each team of Dave's has about five or six people. He's got a good life club leader. That's someone who takes the kids, mm-hmm. you know, in of when they head in to help a village. There's a videographer and they upload information to the State Department mm-hmm. every day mm-hmm. when the Burma army moves in to wipe out a village. They have a pastor. They have a medic. They have a team leader, and they have a security person. Security person might have a knife, might have a rickety old 45 or something like that. But that's just to protect the teams because they're medical supplies, et cetera. I mean, sometimes these teams will reach a village and get the villagers out 15 minutes before the Burma army starts to shell them.
Unbelievable.
And it's just horrible. And what's happening inside there. And so Davis trained all these teams to just help the people and get them into hide sites and start getting their life put back together. And on one trip, a bunch of key leaders had come across the border to meet with us. And David said, hey, they want to ask a question. And because, you know, Dave's whole methodology is they're not there to engage and fight the enemy. They're there to protect people, to rescue people, and to, you know, they'll protect themselves. But right. So some of these people, you know, they've lost their daughters, they've lost their wives, their family, and they would like to go on the offensive. Mm-hmm. And he goes, I understand it, but I told them, it's interesting. I have some friends here, the ones who fund all of these missions. You ask them. Mm-hmm. So it was, I tell you, it was humbling. And to hear them say, we just want to eliminate this evil, evil enemy. And, you know, and I had kind of shared that I see a line that, you know, as far as me, there's a line. And even with King David, you look back at his life, there was a line David crossed.
Yeah.
He wanted to build the temple. God kept him from building the temple because he had so much blood on his hands, so much war, right? So some wars – and we're not necessarily okayed, you would have to think then, by the Almighty in that. So I was just sharing that with them. I said, you know, when you're protecting people and you're fulfilling the mission of rescue, I go, I'm great there. But for you to just become another army unit, well, that's a different line for me. And I can't support that. And, you know, they prayed and they said, okay, we won't. And then they went back across the border.
Wow.
But, you know, in those moments is like, I get why you want to do that. I get why you want revenge.
Yeah.
And to feel their pain and their loss in the midst of that. Yet Jesus calls us to a higher way. Mm. And, you know, they heard that. And I was so impressed with their integrity to say, okay, you know, we've heard your words and we will do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you, there is folly, you know, if you just, okay, we're going to go into open combat with an army and, you know, I mean, you're just going to get more people killed.
Yeah.
It's not a solution, but actually rescuing people and trying to get them out of there. That's a huge win, you know?
It's a huge win. And I think, you know, Jesus is always asking us to leverage our power, our leadership,
resources, our
authority that we do have for the weakest. Yep. How do you leverage that without becoming the enemy is really important.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because when you do leverage it and become the enemy, that's when you come up with doctrines and theologies that are called just war theories.
you're not a Game of Thrones. Are you a Game of Thrones guy?
I did watch Game of Thrones.
Okay. Yeah. So you're outed now. Everybody knows. So that is the exact thing that happened. Right. And I'm totally blowing this. So if you're a Game of Thrones fan, this is a spoiler, spoiler alert. I mean, the idea that I'm going to become so powerful that I can free people, but then I'm going to go around and free everybody that I think needs to be freed, is like, wait, you're becoming the enemy itself. And that
you are,
it's wise to avoid those kinds of entanglements when maybe everything inside you says, yeah, I want to stop that in a violent way as well, you know, but I think that's a very practical way that Christians can respond to the thlipsis. I'm never going to say it right. I always say it wrong. Is that correct? Thlipsis.
Thlipsis.
My Greek is rusty.
Not to take your Game of Thrones analogy any deeper,
but
there was actually an interesting parallel in what you see in the Game of Thrones and what happens in like chapters 12 and 13 of Revelation, mm-hmm. because I call it the unholy trinity, mm-hmm. in Revelation, mm-hmm. where you've got the red dragon, which is Satan, right?
Yep.
Then you have the first beast and the second beast. And when you dig into those, really the first beast was the political system of the world. The second beast was religious system. And so what happens in the world, you see this in Game of Thrones. So all of a sudden when the religious system is wed to the political system, Satan has a heyday with any country and any culture. You look at the times in our history when the church has received political power, we have destroyed people.
We have destroyed people.
I mean, we could talk about the caliphate concept in, in Islam when the church and the political systems come together. It's like, man, John was writing about that vision a long time ago. One of the reasons I actually appreciate the separation of church and state in our early documents. I mean, because that even in Game of Thrones, that gave them this extra power.
Right.
You know, because the you can control religiously. Now you can control politically. And you're just really, really worshiping the dragon in that sense. And I thought that came through in Game of Thrones. I was probably the only one.
Who So when I taught medieval history, one of the things I talk about was the three-headed beast of the medieval period. It was the church, it was the state, and it was the army. And if you ever put those three things together, you wound up with a total disaster, because you can't give that kind of power to anyone without it absolutely making a mess of things. So when you see those three things joined together, then you're in all sorts of trouble. And you know, like you said, it happened in Game of Thrones, but as I watched that, and I think, I too am grateful for the separation of church and state. When I do a wedding, I refuse to say by the power vested in me and in the state of, I will not say that, because that goes all the way back to Theodosius in 410, 400. So now it's 410. Now I'm going to not remember exactly when he did it, but it was in the 400s when Christianity became the actual religion of the Roman Empire. That was the mistake, and I feel like we've been trying to untie that knot ever since. It wasn't Constantine.
Absolutely.
It wasn't Constantine. Constantine, you know, made it legal. Okay, great. So give Christians their stuff back and make it legal. But when all of a sudden the state and the religion are tied together, you have a monster. And theocracies make me really uncomfortable. When people want to press in on the United States being a Christian nation, I get really uncomfortable. I'm like, no. That's not what this is supposed to be. And especially when you look at Revelation, it's like that has nothing to do with – there's no statehood here. There's no government here, you know, where it's, you know, Christians taking over. This is a different deal altogether.
Yeah, absolutely. That should really – I mean – for today's culture, the book of Revelation should be a sobering wake-up call for when the evangelical church weds itself to a political system.
Yeah.
Guess who's really being worshipped here, and I see it over and over and over again. I go, man, what we need are believers in office, obviously, but the way our country has fallen suit to – yeah, back to what you even said, what was happening with Constantine. Yeah, it was about 310 when Constantine converted. Huge things happened to the church. Some people would say, well, it spread throughout the world, so it was God's plan. Maybe. Also, everything shifted because prior to Constantine, the concept of ecclesia, the church, at best, the largest church that existed was, you know, 70 people in Oikos, right? They were house churches, and they were transforming the world. After Constantine, he builds the first church. For the first time, the church is no longer a group of people. A church is a place you went to. And then we went to professional sermons. We went to professional music. And then we had power connected to government. And then we started to become the oppressors as soon as we got the power under Constantine. And it only got worse from there.
Yeah.
And I still think that's a lesson we haven't learned, that Jesus didn't call us to a theocracy. He called us to his kingdom.
That's right. I'm so when people ask my political views, I'm like, well, I'm a monarchist. They're like, what do you mean? And I'm like, yeah. I'm kind of a Jewish monarchist. rather just figure out what it means to live under his authority and call it good. Yeah. Well, Monty, I really appreciate your time sitting with me today, talking about Revelation, talking about your book. Is there anything else going on you want to share with folks who are listening?
Well, right now, things are normal, fun, crazy, busy. I'm starting to work through my next book, which is I did a 1 year journey on St. Francis of Assisi. Mm. So I spent a year just reading everything about him and everything by him. So I've been slowly picking my way through trying to get a book out on that. So I'm hoping to see that out here pretty soon. Jesus is just smiling big in Seattle, having good coffee with us out here.
I got to get up there.
It's a sunny part of the world.
I got to get up there. That coffee is something else, right?
Coffee is something
else. It tastes better when the skies are cloudy and everything's a little cold. So, yeah, it's different than in Phoenix. Down here, it's cold brew. Cold brew like it's going out of style.
No, thanks. Thanks for the dialogue, though. I guess my only parting shots are I think the book of Revelation is it really is a beautiful book. And if you can take it out of a literal chronological view mm-hmm. and begin to see it as this beautiful faceted diamond of angles and story, and that God is in the midst of Philippians, like you said, with us. You know, I think that's a word for the church today, to be wary of the unholy trinity of politics, religion, and to stay focused on Jesus, who's in the center, that Jesus needs to stay the main thing.
Yeah, that's a great word. Yeah, great word. Well, I thank you again for your time. Super glad you were able to join us. And look forward to chatting again.
Sounds good, Bob.
Thanks so much for listening today. You can find out more about our guest, Monty Wright, at montywright.blog. You can find out about all of the different things that he's involved with. You can also follow him on various social media outlets. You can find his book on Revelation, Rescuing Revelation, at amazon.com. You can also find out more about me at bobfaby.com. You can follow me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And you can see that I've written a book called Not My Jesus, Embracing Our Sacred Role in a Changing World. You can track that down at amazon.com or barnesandnoble.com. I want to say thank you so much again for listening, and I wish you many, many blessings.